I'd like to just get right into sort of the main speakers that we've brought to speak tonight. Their names are Will Parrish and Darwin Von Graham. They're both UCSC alumni. And let's see, Darwin's now a grad student at UC Santa Barbara. And Will had definitely wanted me to mention that his diploma had been withheld for his participation in the organizing of Tent University. And I think that was 4 years ago, three or four. And they're going to be presenting some new and some old research that has been conducted and will be coming out in a new book titled University of Mass Destruction. So I'm just going to let them take it away and come on up.
Thanks a lot. Actually, the last time I was in ESLP was right before Tent University Santa Cruz, and I came up and I gave a class wrap, and I got the biggest ovation of my entire life right before I came up, which was basically just half the organizers of Tent University were students in the class at ESLP. So it's really good to be back. And basically, I want to describe exactly what we want to try to get across tonight. Right up front, which is something that I know because you're all here at ESLP that you're all interested in, which is how exactly it is that the University of California contributes to the process by which the global ecosystem of this planet is being destroyed. And in doing that, I want to also talk about The main point is the role that that gives us, the responsibilities that that gives us as people who are part of this institution here, because we are in a very powerful position. We do have a lot of leverage by virtue of the fact that this university system is the largest nuclear weapons contractor for the U.S. government of the past six decades. Every nuclear weapon in the U.S. arsenal was researched and designed by people employed by the University of California. And we'll be talking more about the details of that. That's a side of the university that you usually don't hear a lot about. But that also is a pretty important window into a bigger side of the university that you don't hear about. And that is the fact that since the day that this university system opened its doors, it has been aligned with, has partnered with, been a handmaiden to pretty much the most destructive corporate and military interests in the planet of Mother Earth. And in talking about these things, I want to come back to the theme I mentioned, which is the role that we can play. There's people here doing a lot of really great work in addressing sustainability of the ecosystem of this planet, and doing it in a local context, doing it here where we are at UC Santa Cruz, doing it within the University of California system. But we're going to talk about some ways to get really concrete that we, as people here at the University of California, have a unique role to play in stopping the entire military-industrial complex from producing its most destructive weapons, because the nuclear weapons that have been produced under UC auspices are enough to destroy all life on this planet as we know it at least three times over. So I want to actually, we're going to take a really long view, right? We're going to go back to the very founding of the UC for a bit, kind of set up the context of what we're going to talk about as far as nuclear weapons go, and about the other issues as far as corporatization and militarization go. And to do that, I want to start off by asking you all a question, which is, can anyone here tell me why Berkeley is named Berkeley? Yeah?
I feel like I'm cheating.
Hey, bring it on.
It was named after the line in the poem, West from the Course of the Empire,
Really? Do you want to say why it was cheating exactly?
Because I facilitated
the mom. There we go. All right. So, Ray, the University of California was founded in 1868. The first campus, and it remained the only campus of the UC system for a long time, was Berkeley. And the UC was founded in the context of what was going on at large in the state of California. The process of creating the UC started right after the state of California was created. And that context I'm talking about was basically the genocide of the people who lived here in what is now the state of California. By the most credible estimates that we have available to us, from 1850 to 1890, the population of Native people of what is now this state was reduced by 95%. It's a 95% reduction in four decades. That's not something that you can really gloss over in talking about the history of the state of California. That's something that should be central to our understanding of what happened that led to the creation of institutions like the University of California. And George Berkeley was a philosopher whose ideas were used by the people who were involved with that conquest to justify what they were doing. George Berkeley was a philosopher of the role of education in society, and he was a cleric in the United Kingdom. And he wrote this poem that we just heard about, and it was called America, a Prophecy. The last stanza included a line about westward the course of empire takes its way. And a lot of people here might have heard of the idea of manifest destiny, which was the idea that the people who were the ruling class of the United States had a God-given mission to spread out as far as they could into the areas of the world inhabited by what they called the darker races or the savage races, and spread a form of Christian civilization to those areas. So Berkeley was basically, George Berkeley was capturing that philosophy, led to the idea of manifest destiny being inspired by his poem that we just heard about. And so when the people who founded the University of California at Berkeley set up that town to be the first town to host a University of California, that's exactly what they had in mind as they stood in the hills of Berkeley and looked out across the Pacific Ocean, projected the role that they wanted the University of California to play in the life of American politics and society. So it should come as no surprise, given that inspiration for the UC's founding, that the UC from its beginnings was basically set up to be a breeding ground for the people who were to be the elites of California. We're talking about, you know, the UC being a very exclusive university system when it started. The first graduating class, actually, in 1872, consisted of 12 people who became known as the 12 Apostles because they were some of the most influential people in the state of California and in the nation at shaping the business interests and the government to be oriented toward a certain way of life, a certain way of expansionary life, serving the interests of empire. We're talking about three people who became UC regents. We're talking about a future governor of the state of California, multiple future congresspeople, multiple future executives of large businesses. So that was the beginnings of the UC system, and we get kind of this structure that settles in over time, and the UC doesn't really become an elite university right from the get-go. But a couple things over the course of the late 1800s and early 1900s, skipping ahead, changed things a little bit. And I'll just mention them briefly because they're important to understand in setting up what we're going to talk about. One is, going to hit on this really briefly, the Hearst family, who I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with the name Hearst, William Randolph Hearst, develops a really active interest in the future of the university. Second thing that happens is something called the Spanish-American War, right? 1898, the United States goes to war with Spain, comes away from that war with several new colonial possessions, countries like Cuba and the Dominican Republic. These are the first colonies beyond the territorial corpus of the United States, beyond what you know, indigenous people call Turtle Island, right? So probably the biggest prize that the UC came away with after the Spanish-American War as a colonial possession was the Philippine Islands, right? And it's really important to understand, if you're going to look at the history of the UC, look at the types of interests that led it to become a manager of nuclear weapons labs, look at the role the UC played in administering that colony, the Philippine Islands, because the administrators of the University of California, from the president of the UC at that time, a guy named Benjamin I. Wheeler, who now has a building called Wheeler Hall named after him up at UC Berkeley, for those who've been there, other administrators, the guy who took over from Wheeler as president, the founder of the political science department, who I'm going to read a quote from in just a second, a guy named Bernard Moses. These were the people who ran the educational system of the Philippines after the United States took it over. And they basically ran the educational system in a way that took the traditional societies of the Philippines and conducted a process called re-education, right? Basically educating the people who were to be the new elite of the Philippines, administering it on behalf of the U.S. Colonial empire that was emerging at that time. So the UC played a role in that sense, but even more interesting, I think, is that the UC actually began orienting a lot of its educational programs at Berkeley toward what was going on in the Philippines, created a new four-year beet and sugar ranching course and program to train students to go be administrators of the new beet and sugar ranches getting set up in these colonies. They created a new College of Commerce that was to help facilitate trade from this new trade outpost in the Philippines. And you can rattle them off for a little while longer. And there's a lot of programs that came out of that period that exist today that were created basically out of the Spanish-American War. So if you're going to look at the growth of the UC, the emergence of the UC, you got to look at the role that it played at that time in this war that went on for 13 years, was basically the precursor in a lot of ways to, you know, the Vietnam War, to the Iraq War. 300,000 Filipinos died in that war, which is a very significant percentage of the population, and the ecology of the Philippines was totally transformed by it. So, giving a little historical context here, skipping ahead for a second, the UC at that time was very militarized, and a lot of people here will probably be surprised to know, because this type of thing doesn't really exist now, and we can go into why a little bit later, but the UC actually had a very large standing army at Berkeley at that time and a very extensive military training program. And you can go back to the 1900 yearbook of the University of California. They call it the Blue and Gold. And what they say in there is that we are very proud of the role that our trainees in our military program are playing in the Philippines and in the Spanish-American War. We have the largest military training program of any institution, educational institution in the country, except for the West Point Training Academy for the Army and the Annapolis Training Academy, also a military training academy. So the UC at this point is very proud of the role that its military training program is performing on behalf of these things going on with the colonization of countries far away. So there's other sides to this idea of militarization. The long-range development plan speakers brought up how there's links between militarization and things like the new biosciences building going on and the other buildings that are planned under the long-range development plan. And, you know, I think the point to underscore here is that empire, expansion of a country's interests, of the economic interests of the country, happens in various ways. One way is through the military, one way is through the armed forces. There's other ways too. The UC has been involved in a lot of other ways in those processes. And I'm a certified, I took a permaculture course, and I'm a practicing permaculturist, and I'm guessing a lot of other people here are too. So I've got a personal interest in agriculture and industrial agriculture, how that the forms of agriculture that we have now, which are completely unsustainable and unjust and very environmentally destructive, came into being So if you'd like me in that sense, you'd probably be interested to know that the University of California has had agricultural programs that conducted research for the agricultural industry since the get-go. And probably the most important contribution the UC has made to the agricultural practices on a global scale of multinational corporations and big agricultural industry came in the early 1900s when a foundation set up by the Bank of America gave a large grant to the University of California at Berkeley Agricultural Program and the University Farm, what's now UC Davis, which basically led to the forms of monocrop agricultural practices that are now prevalent in the Central Valley, right? That used to be a thriving ecosystem. The UC received research grants that led to its research in these petroleum, chemical-intensive forms of agriculture. You can look up more information on that if you want to write down the Giannini Foundation. It's something that's really worth looking into. And that was basically the basis for a lot of forms of agriculture that we see around the world that came from something called the Green Revolution, right? That spread similar types of monocrop agriculture across the planet. So the UC has had a role from its inception in these types of practices, and we're at a point right now, as you all very much understand, I'm sure have totally internalized by this point in your lives, especially if you're in this class, you've heard all the speakers that have come before Darwin and I in this speaker series, that we're at a critical point in this planet. We're at a point where the future of all our relations, all life on this planet, because of these emerging ecological crises, whether you want to mention global warming, whether you want to mention depletion of topsoil from the types of agricultural practices I just mentioned, whether you want to mention the water crisis, whether you want to mention nuclear weapons proliferation, whether you want to mention the nuclear waste crisis, whether you want to mention all kinds of other problems that we could point to, toxification of the total environment. We're at a point where it's critical that we look at exactly what role we are all playing in those being perpetuated, because the future generations of life on this planet, such as they're going to be, may live to thank us for the role we play in turning the tide and turning back to the course of empire that we are currently on. And I think that we talked about the Berkeley poem, right? So it was called America, a Prophecy. And it was prophetic in a lot of ways, and I want you to pay particular attention to the last line of the last stanza of the poem, which I'm going to recite for you. And then Darwin's going to get up here, and we're going to trade off talking in short segments for the rest of the time that we're up here. The poem was this: westward the course of empire takes its way. The first four acts already passed. The fifth and final shall close the day. Time's noblest offspring is its last. So, time's noblest offspring is its last. The University of California has played a very decisive role in a lot of ways, and we're going to talk about some more. We're going to focus especially on nuclear weapons throughout its history and leading us to the crisis we're in. And we are possibly entering into a period of time where the last generations of life as we know it are going to be born. A lot of people have talked about that in this lecture series. So we're going to be talking about all these things a little bit more tonight. We're going to get into the nuclear weapons program a little bit more. And now Darwin is going to flesh out some things about who it is who actually is the group of people in charge of this university and shaping it in the ways I've been talking about. Thank you very much. This is a land-grant university. So the University of California was established, like most land-grant universities in the United States, in the latter half of the 1800s through an act of Congress called the Morrill Act. The Morrill Act set aside huge portions of land in the states for the establishment of agricultural and mechanical arts universities and colleges. So who rules this university?
Like most land-grant universities, the charter was under statutory, the form of statutory law, state of California. So the initial charter that created the UC, what it did was it subordinated the University of California to the control of the legislature, and it created a somewhat ambiguous corporate form for the university. In the late 1800s, this was a period of political upheaval in the state of California. And one of the largest, one of the most formative struggles was that between a group of populists and a group of elites. The populists were farmers in the state of California. They were smallholders. They owned at most upwards of 100 acres. Most of them owned far less than that. These were people who were farming mostly fruit and other agricultural products. Some of them were ranchers. And these people wanted a form of kind of Jeffersonian democracy. They wanted a very decentralized state government, but they wanted a state government that was federalist and that would provide them with the resources they needed to exercise more widespread democratic power. And they were particularly interested in the creation of a college for the agricultural arts, as a smallholding farmer would want that to be. Opposed to them was a group of bankers and lawyers, primarily living in San Francisco. These were the bankers and lawyers who owned the railroad corporations of California and the emerging large monocrop agricultural businesses that Will spoke briefly of, that were beginning to come about in the Central Valley. These were the land barons who owned places like, is anyone from Southern California, do you know where the Tejon Ranch is? Tejon Ranch? These are people who, the Tejon Ranch actually was owned by a UC Regent back in the late 1800s, and it was a massive cattle pasture. And so these bankers and lawyers, mostly centered in San Francisco, they wanted a university for different reasons. They wanted a university that would teach liberal arts and educate and socialize the mostly white, well, the all-white, and mostly male sons of the power elite of the state. They wanted to reproduce their class, basically. So these were two fundamentally opposed and competing visions for the university. In 1879, there was a second California Constitutional Convention. And what happened was these bankers and lawyers from San Francisco managed to rewrite the charter of the University of California and make it constitutional rather than statutory. Now, I know that sounds jargony, but here's the difference. The University of California is now, because of this, in effect, a massive parastatal corporation that is neither a university nor a corporation. It is more like a fourth branch of state government. If you actually look at how the university operates, it's more like a fourth branch of the state government. It has significant autonomy and independence from the legislature, from the judicial, and from the executive branches of state government. The California Assembly cannot pass a law to make the University of California do this or do that per se. It takes constitutional ratification to make the university different. Why is this important? This story is important to the foundation of the university because, think about it, the Board of Regents was established and the University of California was codified explicitly to thwart a social movement. Explicitly to thwart a social movement, a populist uprising of farmers who wanted the university to be a particular way. And to make the university necessarily less accountable to that movement, these bankers and lawyers and the people who own the railroads and most of the landholdings in the state of California and most of the mining corporations reformed the Constitution to make the UC run by a Board of Regents who are politically unaccountable to all of us. Into the legislature. I'm going to read to you a quote from, this was written by the Legislative Council of California. This is like a lawyer to the State Assembly. This is from 1989. This lawyer is describing essentially what the regents are. and what kind of power they possess. I mean, he's writing this to a state senator who was like, what is the university? I don't know, I'm a state senator. How can I pass laws that affect the university? So the council says, the regents, and they're writing about what happened in 1879. The regents suddenly possess exclusive power to operate, control, and administer the University of California, and as a result of this grant of constitutional authority to the regents, the legislature is not authorized to intervene directly in the internal administration and affairs of the university. The powers of the regents no longer derive from the legislature in any form, but rather from the people, because it's constitutional now, and thus the structure of the university cannot be altered by statute. So, effectively, the university is run by these board of regents. The regents are the people you write your checks out to, and they're totally unaccountable to all of us because they are accountable to us, the people of the state of California. It's kind of a paradox, but that's how it exists today. The board of regents is 26 members. Most of them are appointed by the governor. If you look at who these people are, they, for the most part, constitute the economic elite of the state of California. This is something that you can see over time. So again, the period of the late 1800s, most of the regents are businessmen who were part of the pioneer class who came from the Midwest and East Coast to colonize California for the manifesting U.S. empire. So most of them were involved in the key economic sectors of that day, which included cattle, included emerging plantation agriculture, railroads, big time railroads, and it included banking, of course, and the big one was mining. Because why was California even constituted as a state, right? Mines, gold. In the mid 20th century, a different kind of economic elite forms in the state of California because the economy is developing and changing. And these elite also recognize the necessity of running the University of California. So the University of California's Board of Regents becomes primarily, the primary representatives of the economic elite are reflected in different economic sectors. So if you look at the Board of Regents, say around World War II, what you find is a predominance of businessmen who own large industrial manufacturing enterprises, because California is quickly industrializing. A lot of these industries are military industries. Los Angeles during World War II, the Los Angeles metropolitan region established the single largest ever assembled military aerospace industrial complex in the history of the planet. San Diego's just a close second behind. They were pumping out tens of thousands of airplanes and missiles. Mostly airplanes and artillery. They would turn out missiles after the war. That's a different story. The Bay Area saw the establishment of the largest military shipyards during World War II, and one of the owners of those shipyards was a UC Regent and has a corporation named after him, which we'll get into later. You see a lot of bankers again and lawyers, and you see on the Board of Regents men who own petroleum corporations. So the University of California for most of the 20th century is run essentially by the executive committee of the global oil industry. It's got people like Samuel Mosher, which anyone from Santa Barbara who've been to Santa Barbara? Yeah, Mosher owned a lot of the oil drilling leases out in Santa Barbara, profited immensely from that. He was the UC Regent for quite a while. You have people like Edwin Pauley. You have a lot of petroleum industry executives talking about how sustainable the UC is. The people who ran the UC for most of the 20th century are the people responsible for the industry that has extracted petroleum and emitted all this carbon in our atmosphere. Today, the University of California is mostly run by finance capitalists. So people like the current chair of regents, Richard Bloom, the past chair of regents, Gerald Parsky. These are people who have big pots of money that buy corporations and then sell them at a profit, and that's pretty much all these guys do. That's what a finance capitalist is. And you see the predominance of people involved in software and computing industries, the semiconductor industry, high technology, biotechnology, now nanotechnology, because you're seeing people coming onto the Board of Regents who represent the new economic elite of the state of California, and you see still lawyers and bankers, because the capitalism model is always going to have lawyers and mentors running things. So why do these people run the university? It's pretty simple. The university has increasingly become, as an institution, more and more fundamental to the formation of capital. And we now live in a post-industrial economy, far more so than someone like Daniel Bell could ever have predicted. Capital and value is formed now mostly in the production of new technologies. So the University of California really is the economic engine of the state. And so determining what kind of economy we're going to have in California is largely, in a large part actually, up to the people who determine what kind of educational system we have here. And the last thing I wanted to do was give you just a few more little bios on some of the regents, and then hand it back over to Will. When I said that amongst past industries, so in the late 1800s, you know, you had people like Adolf Spreckels on the Board of Regents. Will mentioned that Berkeley established a beet sugar, what was it called? Beet and sugar ranching training four-year program. Would you take that? That sounds really exciting. Well, maybe they formed that because at the time one of the regents was Adolf Spreckels, who was the sugar baron of North America. He owned a large portion of Hawaii. There's a city named after him in California called Spreckels. And if you ever see a street or a city named called Spreckels, it's probably named after Adolf Spreckels. Spreckels was the sugar baron, owned part of Hawaii, and a huge swath of the Salinas Valley, grew beets, and grew sugar cane to refine sugar. Well, maybe that has something to do with the foundation of that school. You had people like Truxton Beale. Truxton Beale was a corporate lawyer. Truxton Beale wrote extensive papers about how colonization of the Philippines was extremely important for the development of the U.S. economy. Truxton Beale also wrote a lot of papers to try to form U.S. policy, or, for instance, around the issue of the Chinese in North America. His position was in favor of passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act. He did not want Chinese immigration into North America. And he actually wrote a paper called The Strategical Value of the Philippines, in which he, and this guy was a regent, right? As he's writing his paper, he's also a corporate lawyer, and he's thinking, the strategical value of the Philippines is basically that it provides us a launching pad for us to gain economic footholds into China, because China is one of the largest markets for both labor and for goods on the planet. So you have people like that. And in the 20th century, I mentioned Edwin Pauley. You also have people who are like board of directors of Lockheed Martin Corporation, these huge aerospace companies that are merging and forming during and after World War II. I'm gonna leave off at the present, because I'll give you some more bios of some of the regents who are currently on the board. I'll hand it back over to Will for you.
Is this level of volume all right for people in the back? Okay. So Darwin and I both learned about the UC's involvement with nuclear weapons when we were students here at UC Santa Cruz. And ever since then, it's basically been a process of like, how far down the rabbit hole do you want to go? And so basically, my goal in the very short amount of time that I have here with you all is to take you as far down as I possibly can, given that short amount of time, if that's all right with you. So that's going to be what this segment's about for me. So the UC, I like being right out front here. So the UC, back in the part of the century where I left off, in the early 20th century, was part of an economy in California that was putting more emphasis on physical and applied sciences, right? And so this guy named Ernest Lawrence gets imported to the UC by the president of the university, a guy named Robert Sproul, from Yale. And basically from the day this guy arrives at UC Berkeley in 1928, he is groomed to be the physicist of the UC that is going to help take the UC Berkeley physics program from kind of a fledgling little program to a top-notch physics program that's like world-class and churning out the best and brightest physicists in the country, right? So this guy, Ernest Lawrence, comes up with an idea that kind of like steals it from a graduate student, actually, of creating something called a cyclotron. And basically what that was and is, we'll talk about that, is a device that accelerates at increasing speed and has a powerful magnet attached to it, which separates atoms as they spin around on this cyclotron, so you can study the properties of atoms, the building blocks of life, right? And by doing that, you unlock all kinds of scientific potential, all kinds of fancy things can come out of that. Ernest Lawrence develops this idea. He's the first person in the world to do it. And right away, people recognize this is a big thing here. Ernest Lawrence gets personally invited by that guy, Robert Sprout, president of the university at the time, into something that, who here has heard of the Bohemian Grove? Okay, so Bohemian Grove, little camping complex on a fork of the Russian River up in Sonoma County, right? It's basically a men's club, an elite club, secret club, really. Only men have been allowed for the vast majority of the time that it's been in existence. Robert Sprout, president of the university, is an honorary lifetime member. That's the status bestowed upon only the cream of the crop, right? He invites Lawrence in. Ernest Lawrence, at the Bohemian Grove, meets the people who are going to be his political allies for the remainder of his career and his primary funders. These are mainly people who are members of the UC Board of Regents. And these include people, Darwin mentioned bankers, he mentioned lawyers. Well, Ernest Lawrence's main political ally was a guy named John Francis Nyland. We're throwing out a lot of names. This one's an important one to remember. John Francis Nyland was the personal attorney for William Randolph Hearst. He was the publisher of William Randolph Hearst's 5 newspapers in California. And he was also a major oil baron and land developer. He makes it his personal mission, right, to get Ernest Lawrence all the funding he needs to develop the cyclotron concept into the biggest and best facility for physics at the UC Berkeley campus that he possibly can. He gets funding from UC Regents, who are bankers and other industrials. At that time, most of the funding for these things was private. It didn't come from public universities. And by the year 1940, Ernest Lawrence, the guy whose name adorns Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory at UC Berkeley, and also the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, one of the 2 nuclear weapons complexes that we're talking about, is the most famous scientist in the United States. He's won a Nobel Prize. He's the first American physicist to do that. He's been on the cover of Time magazine. He's been on the cover of the New York Times. This guy is basically the pride and joy of the university by the year 1940. In 1940, he receives a large grant from the Rockefeller Foundation, large grant-making foundation, for the next cyclotron, right? They celebrate at the Bohemian Grove the receipt of this grant. I've looked at Ernest Lawrence's papers. They're at UC Berkeley. They're at something called the Bancroft Library. There's thousands upon thousands of pages. You can learn a lot about the guy's life, and in doing that, you can learn a lot about how the U.S. nuclear weapons program developed. Okay, so what I'm talking about mainly comes from there for the next little bit. Rockefeller Foundation trustee who gave that grant gives the introduction to Ernest Lawrence's speech that he gives at the Bohemian Grove, says, and I'm going to actually give a quote here of this one because it's pretty telling. It's the only reason I got my laptop up here is to pull out these quotes. This guy, who's a major military industrialist, the Rockefeller Foundation states, "You may believe that the war in Europe, World War II, has started, is the most important thing that is going on for the human race at the present time. But actually, it may prove that the events which are about to take place on the University of California campus are of much more far-reaching significance to humanity." Okay, so earlier that year, substance called plutonium has been discovered at UC Berkeley using one of the cyclotrons, and plutonium has aptly been called the most toxic substance on Earth. It comes from, it's separated from natural occurring uranium, the heaviest of the elements, periodic table of elements right up there, you can probably find it. Uranium is also, uranium is basically the building block of nuclear weapons as we know them, right? So plutonium has been discovered. This is a substance that, if you inhale a very microscopic quantity of it, can be fatal, cause fatal cancer. One person, Helen Caldicott, has estimated that if you spread a pound of plutonium in just the right way across the Earth, that it could kill every person on the planet, all 7 billion of them roughly right now. So we're talking extremely toxic substance, but it also revealed that the U.S. nuclear weapons program could definitely go forward because plutonium provides the core for nuclear weapons, right? So a lot of excitement among people, types of people who are taking part in the Bohemian Grove about the potential for the work at Berkeley to create a new type of weapon. People were, at that point, unfamiliar with exactly what it would be, but they knew it would be huge because there was a very active program already in existence to research nuclear weapons and that led to their development. And the guy who basically organized that program more than any other person was this guy, Ernest Lawrence, with the pride and joy of UC Berkeley, ran the UC Radiation Lab that housed the cyclotrons. In 1942, he meets with the key scientists involved in the nuclear weapons program in the United States at the Bohemian Grove, convenes that meeting. That's where they pretty much lay out the steps it's going to take to develop nuclear weapons for the United States. Leads to the creation of a secret facility at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, that is going to separate the uranium that's going to be used to create nuclear weapons for the U.S. And the devices that separate uranium are called calutrons. Calutrons. Why are they called calutrons? Cal, UC Berkeley. So the University of California, at this point, is basically, through Ernest Lawrence, administrating the U.S. nuclear weapons program. The Los Alamos nuclear weapons facility gets created the following year. U.S. government basically ratifies something called the Manhattan Project, which is basically just a way to describe a program that was already going on, but it led to the funding stream that was going to be necessary, right, from the U.S. government to lead to the nuclear weapons getting created that are already in process. So, 1945, first two nuclear weapons are created, used in Japan as World War II is winding down. So created at Los Alamos. UC manages Los Alamos, so these are created by people who are affiliated with the University of California, instantly vaporized in the case of Hiroshima. About 80,000 people. In the case of Nagasaki, about 70,000. Those are estimates. Leads to a lot more deaths in the years to come. Very important to understand this kind of complicated historical terrain, right? But the war's winding down. Japan's on the verge of surrendering. Why were the nuclear weapons actually used? Well, a year after the bombings happened, the U.S. government creates this justification that the Japanese weren't going to surrender otherwise, right? That justification didn't exist before it was pretty much invented. The Japanese were on the verge of surrendering. This was unnecessary, but what it was demonstrating the power of these nuclear weapons because everybody knew. Recall that meeting at the Bohemian Grove I mentioned that I found in Ernest Lawrence's papers and that other people have written about. Everyone knew that these weapons were going to change the course of humanity. The U.S. wanted to show that it had them, and it was able to use them. That's the main reason those were used. And so the U.S. nuclear weapons program is underway. And at the time, there's kind of a debate, right, among people who were involved with the nuclear weapons program, scientists, administrators, about whether to keep going with it. Some people, like at the University of Chicago, which was pretty involved, Harvard University, they actually demobilized, they downscaled their involvement with nuclear weapons, they got out. Other people, though, at the University of California, other places, same people who pretty much nurtured the nuclear weapons program into existence in the first place, they keep organizing, they keep moving it forward, okay? And the UC regents did not know what they were getting into, some of them, when the nuclear weapons program started. And the president of the UC, this guy Sproul, I mentioned, he wants the UC to get out. He's not comfortable with it at first. But two members of the regents, okay, are very instrumental in keeping the UC connected with the nuclear weapons program. Those are Nylon, the guy I mentioned earlier, the attorney for Hearst, and another guy named Edwin Pauley, who Garo mentioned. Actually, he's an official of the Pentagon, right? So when the UC starts making noise about getting out of the nuclear weapons program, okay,
Hawley and other people at the Pentagon inform the president's office of the UC that President Harry Truman will want to meet with you if you go forward with the Annapolis nuclear weapons program. And other Pentagon officials are going to show up on your doorstep and have a press conference. And they're going to say that we want the UC to keep being involved. The UC stays involved. And it's basically, the UC's involvement is run by a committee created on the Regents to administer the nuclear weapons relationship with the UC. This guy, Nyland, pretty much runs that committee when it starts. So the UC continues, and in 1949, the Soviet Union detonates its first nuclear weapon. And at that point, there's a big debate about what should happen next. And the next innovation in nuclear weapons is something called the hydrogen bomb, much more destructive than the weapons that were originally created to drop on Hiroshima and Nagasaki by a huge factor. And basically what happens within the UC camp is that Ernest Lawrence goes to Washington and lobbies to create a new nuclear weapons facility at Livermore, along with the University of Chicago scientist Edward Teller. And they help convince the US government to sponsor a new nuclear weapons facility that the UC will manage at Livermore. That gets created specifically to create a hydrogen bomb. So here, bottom line, the UC manages now the two nuclear weapons labs doing research and design for the US government, Los Alamos and Livermore. Berkeley is very involved with all of this. And so the UC pulls a major coup in 1952 because they recruit Edward Teller, the guy I just mentioned from the University of Chicago, to come be a faculty member at UC Berkeley. And with that, the UC has the two most powerful nuclear weapons scientists in the country as faculty members, Ernest Lawrence and Edward Teller. They have a monopoly on the research and design of nuclear weapons for the US government. And they have something that was called the Atomic Trust. The UC has total control as an administrative capacity to decide the course of research and design of US nuclear weapons at this point. So the hydrogen bomb gets created, the US nuclear weapons program moves forward, the Cold War is off and running, as it's, Cold War so called. And so the UC, I actually want to mention something here. Has anyone seen the movie Dr. Strangelove? Okay. So it's pretty commonly thought, right, that the guy that Dr. Strangelove was based on was Edward Teller. So Edward Teller, Dr. Strangelove was a UC Berkeley scientist, it's pretty fair to say. And this guy was a Hungarian physicist, came over during the Manhattan Project, basically was the most influential scientist of the Cold War. And he was a UC Berkeley scientist, right? And this guy, at every step of the way throughout the Cold War, this guy is in Washington. He is talking to the most influential people in policymaking circles, trying to get more funding for nuclear weapons programs, whether they were needed for any justifiable reason or not. Okay. And there's other people involved with this nuclear weapons project that are pretty important to mention. We could talk about a whole lot of them. We could do an entire lecture series probably on each regent who was involved with the nuclear weapons program. There's one guy I want to mention in particular tonight because, he has a pretty strong relationship to UC Santa Cruz. Who here has ever walked or driven upon or whatever, interacted with McLaughlin Drive? Okay, so does anyone know why McLaughlin Drive is named McLaughlin Drive? Okay, I'm not going to actually wait this time. I'm actually just going to tell you. There was a guy named Donald McLaughlin who was a UC Regent from 1952 to 1968. And he was a member of kind of the inner circle of the Hearst family. One of the Hearst people was like an adopted mother to him. He was involved with mining. He was a UC Berkeley Dean of Engineering in 1941. Okay. And he became a UC Regent later. But what's important to know about him the most with what I'm talking about is that this is the guy who chaired the committee of the new Atomic Energy Commission of the federal government to oversee the nuclear weapons program that decided on the uranium mining policy of the US government. So this guy, who's a gold mining corporation executive, sets the policies of the government in uranium mining. Immediately after he leaves that committee, his corporation moves into uranium mining, and within the course of a few years, it has the biggest uranium mining contracts, is producing the most uranium for the U.S. government of any corporation in the country. I mean, Martha Stewart got thrown in jail for so much less than that. Anyway, so important things to know about McLaughlin C. If you really dedicate yourself to a subject and have kind of a reputation for being involved, maybe find allies in the most unexpected places. And I've actually had the privilege of looking at some of Donald McLaughlin's personal files that he kept at his house in Berkeley when he was involved with all this stuff. And it's shocking some of the things that you find in those files. It really says a lot about a person, and I'm going to just figure out how this thing actually works. So I don't know if I'm going to be successful here. Maybe Mark can help me. I'll show what's in the files in a second. So Donald McLaughlin was a very good friend of Edward Teller, a very good friend of Ernest Lawrence. He's the type of person who served on the Regents. He personally profited from uranium mining. He was involved with decision-making about nuclear weapons through advisory committees. This is what's in Donald McLaughlin's files from his house at Berkeley, and you might wonder why that is. Well, the reason why that is that in the 1950s and early 60s, the UC Regents who were involved with this were really sentimental and enthusiastic about their role in developing nuclear weapons. Okay, and they would often be invited to places where nuclear weapons tests were going to take place. In the U.S. case, all the nuclear weapons testing the U.S. did was in the Marshall Islands in the South Pacific. 67 nuclear weapons were detonated there from 1946 to 58. That's the equivalent in explosive power of 1.6 Hiroshima bombs going off every single day for over 12 years. Okay. Nevada, at the Nevada nuclear test site, about 90 miles outside Vegas, the U.S. detonated over 900 nuclear weapons officially. Most of those were underground, a lot were above ground. The distinction's artificial in some ways as far as the effects on the environment. So the Regents would come to places like the Marshall Islands as an invitation of the scientists who were doing these tests, who were affiliated with Los Alamos and Livermore. And they would celebrate these explosions happening because it was to them this idea of the triumph of the spirit of the university's scientific program in unlocking the secrets of nature. And look what we can accomplish. Watching thermonuclear fireballs rise above the Pacific Ocean as we sit in our Adirondack chairs, tanning in the sun, while the people who are going to have to go back and stay inhabited at the places where the radioactive fallout has been deposited serve us our great tropical drinks. That's the type of thing that went on. And you can find it, descriptions of this in files of Regents that are housed at libraries of the UC. You can find them in Ernest Lawrence's papers. These Regents would celebrate nuclear bomb tests. Later on, they would get sent pictures of the blast, put them on their walls. In McLaughlin's case, he actually had a picture of the first nuclear weapons explosion conducted by the United States in New Mexico on his wall at his office at UC Berkeley for pretty much his entire professional career post-World War II. And he would tell people breathlessly who would come meet with him in his office that Ernest Orlando Lawrence once sat in the chair that you were about to sit in. So these people were enthusiastic about nuclear weapons in a way that is hard to understand if you're not part of the same culture these guys were a part of. And it's hard to get your brain around the juxtaposition, right, of utter destruction and celebration going on in the same physical space. But that's basically, in a nutshell, the role and the function of the university. It celebrates nuclear weapons science by being involved with these nuclear weapons labs, and at the same time, it endorses this horrific destruction. In the case of the Marshall Islands, you have islands within the chain that have been totally vaporized. You have islands where people still live, and there's cancer rates that are hundreds of times the predicted rate of certain types of cancers. So that's one of the founders of UC Santa Cruz, Donald McLaughlin. That's why there's a road named after him here. And that's a pretty good point of departure for me to talk about the last little segment, you know, the last little part of this segment I'm going to do, which is the punctive effect that the UC's involvement had, you know, nuclear weapons had on the actual individual campuses of the UC. And this is probably the part of the UC's relationship to nuclear weapons that has not been told nearly to the degree that it should be, because people have written about the UC's involvement in the weapons labs and talked about it, but they haven't talked about this part very much. And it's really important because the UC, you could talk about a major connection to the nuclear weapons program from every campus in the UC system. Like, don't even get me started on UC Merced, right, which just opened. There's all kinds of connections you can draw. In the case, you know, a pretty obvious one is UC Los Angeles, which ended up with what was supposed to be the first nuclear reactor on the West Coast, to train people in atomic science. And the reason that the UC decided to create a nuclear reactor at UCLA was because they said, well, actually, I'm going to read a quote quickly here from a guy who was on the committee that decided upon the policies of the regents to create the nuclear reactor. He was a guy named Stephen Bechtel. And here is his quotes. Okay, I can't find his quote right now, but basically what he said was that the UC has a responsibility due to its involvement in atomic science to go as far as it can in developing atomic science for the benefit of California industry. Stephen Bechtel. 1955, Ernest Lawrence travels to Japan with a guy who was the chairman director of a corporation called General Dynamics, which who here is from San Diego? So General Dynamics, based in San Diego, right? So something just happens, pretty politically significant. One of the U.S. nuclear weapons tests in the Marshall Islands vaporized a fishing boat, a Japanese fishing vessel, killed 12 people aboard, and there was a major backlash in Japan. It was like, this is the second time that we've had a nuclear bomb attack effectively on our people. Total rejection of moves by the Japanese government to go into a nuclear weapons program. Major public relations crisis about nuclear technology. So Ernest Lawrence, basically the main missionary of nuclear weapons for the U.S., travels to Japan with the chairman of General Dynamics Corporation to promote nuclear power in Japan because they're having a political crisis and they need help. So they come back from that tour, and a few months later, in San Diego, is created a new branch of General Dynamics Corporation called General Atomics, right, that manufactures nuclear-powered submarines for the U.S. government and ends up being involved with every single aspect of the nuclear fuel chain, uranium mining, milling of uranium, development of nuclear power plants, development of all kinds of nuclear-powered missiles and things like that. And 1955 in San Diego, there wasn't a campus of the UC. There was something called the Scripps Institute. And how that became UC San Diego was that General Atomics Corporation took $1 million out of its coffers, gave it to the UC regents, said, we want to have a university at UC San Diego. And why would they want that? They wanted that, they said very explicitly in the negotiations, that you can go to Bancroft Library, it's a magical place, and read. And it's because we need to train people to be part of this General Atomics Corporation. We're going into the atomics business. It's very highly skilled people that are part of that, with specialized knowledge. University can probably train those people. Within 5 years, UC San Diego gets created in 1960. You can go to Wikipedia, you can go to UC San Diego's official website. It does mention that General Dynamics provided a donation that led to the creation of UC San Diego. And that was basically because UC San Diego wanted employees at General Atomics, and the first chancellor of UC San Diego was a guy named Herbert York, who was also the first director of the Livermore Nuclear Weapons Lab. okay? And there was a huge particle accelerator that was brought to UC San Diego to train people in atomic science so they could go work for General Atomics Corporation. And we've seen the effects that General Atomics has had in developing all kinds of nuclear technology since then. So I'm not going to let UC Santa Cruz off the hook at all and talk about different campuses. Real quick, just want to mention something kind of important that I'm going to wrap this up about UC Santa Cruz and how it was born in the shadow of the hydrogen bomb in a way. In 1957, Edward Teller, Dr. Strangelove, that I was based on, proposes a new campus of the UC for the UC administration to be based at Livermore. It was basically to be a UC version of the California Institute of Technology based in Livermore to train scientists to go work for the Livermore lab. Luckily, the UC faculty senate in charge of programs like that, they basically won the right over the years to decide on these matters regarding creating new campuses, right? They rejected that proposal, even though it had a lot of support from people like Donald McLaughlin, because they said, we want to situate a campus in the South Bay, and the campus they're talking about ended up becoming UC Santa Cruz. So you could say that we were born in the shadow of the hydrogen bomb, because in a way, UC Santa Cruz being created was a response to this proposal by Teller. So, you know, there's all kinds of links we can draw. We can go on all night. We're writing a book about this stuff. You can pick it up and read it when it's out, and it goes into all this stuff in a lot more explicit detail. But there's points I want to get to really quick before I hand this back over to Darwin, which are that, first of all, nuclear weapons are, you know, the public image that things have are so often so far from what they really are. Say the UC in so many ways, some ways not, in some ways it is totally far off from its public image. Nuclear weapons have a certain image. Basically, nuclear weapons throughout the Cold War. And we can get into this a lot more detail. If you look at how they were actually being used, they were being used by the US and the Soviet Union to intimidate one another, yes, but they were being used more than that for securing markets of investments for US financial interests. They're being used to threaten other countries. The US threatened to use nuclear weapons 40 times in the last 60 plus years against other countries. That's the main function nuclear weapons has, ultimate enforcement in foreign policy. And it's not just this abstract realm of foreign policy, it's day-to-day things that are a miserable addition to the human experience that nuclear weapons have led to. I talked about indigenous genocide briefly at the beginning of this talk. If you look at who's been the most affected across the board by nuclear weapons in this country, it's been Native people in this country. Those are where uranium has been mined the most. That's where nuclear weapons tests have been conducted. American Indians did not go away. They are still here with us. They are being subjected, and you could definitely say, to new forms of genocide, and one that has been described as something called nuclear colonialism, very important to look into. Another point I want to make real quick is that you can really well understand the role that the UC has played in nuclear weapon science. If you look at something that happened in the late 60s, basically the guy who was the second in command of the UC, like under the president of the UC, because the UC has a regents, it has the office of the president. Those two entities interact with each other to make decisions for the UC. Second in command of the UC office of the president is the guy who's in charge of administering for the UC the nuclear weapons labs. Like, he has that function, right? And his name is Earl Bolton. And there's this link you could look at between the Central Intelligence Agency and nuclear weapons that's interesting. And there's one here because in 1968, Earl Bolton was brought to the CIA's headquarters in Langley, Virginia, I think it is, and gave a 2-week seminar to the CIA on how to more effectively recruit students into the Central Intelligence Agency. This came out in the late 70s in the Los Angeles Times. You can go back to the archives and look at the stories on it. Earl Bolton says to the CIA, in a written paper telling them how to more effectively bring people into the CIA from university campuses, that the most important thing the agency can do is by relating work for the agency to one of the traditional functions of the university, such as teaching, research, or public service. When necessary, the university and individual scholars should explain the involvement of the agency as a contribution to one of those proper academic goals. He went on to recommend ways to convince professors to work with the agency. One was that the CIA should set up institutions with no apparent connection to intelligence research. Such an independent corporation should, of course, have a ringing name, direct quote, e.g., Institute for a Free Society. So, Earl Bolton gained a lot of expertise he's using to advise the CIA from being liaison to the nuclear weapons labs for the UC. And it's interesting to look at that at the fact that in 1969, students start to, you know, have an upsurgence, start to rebel against the UC's role with nuclear weapons as part of, you know, the larger anti-war movement going on. People are looking at their own university's connections. Students do that at Berkeley in a big way. The Regents were anticipating that would happen. If you look at files that they kept from the time, they talk about this stuff with each other. And this guy, Earl Bolton, wrote a question and answer document for the UC Regents and the UC Office of the President, basically as a way to anticipate questions they would get and points of contention they would get about the UC's involvement with nuclear weapons. And it's verbatim, practically, what he told the CIA. Okay? That is the role that UC is playing, is providing legitimacy to the nuclear weapons complex, providing a funnel for scientists to go into the nuclear weapons complex. These weapons labs aren't called nuclear weapons labs in their titles, you might notice. They're called the Los Alamos National Laboratory and the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. These are supposed to be national scientific research institutions. Over 80% of their budgets are for nuclear weapons research and development. Big chunk of the rest is for so-called nuclear nonproliferation. Big chunk of the rest is for nuclear waste cleanup. What you're left with when you break all that down is a couple percent for things called science, and things like solar energy research, and things that are more palatable, that are better, you know, as far as public relations tools to recruit scientists and to project a favorable public image. So that's the role the University of California has played. For the, you know, that's the biggest role, recruitment of scientists, legitimacy of nuclear weapons. I'm going to leave it there. Darwin's going to talk a little bit more, and then we're going to wrap this thing up. And if people want to hang around for discussion about this stuff, we are here as long as you want.
Is this a lot of information? Okay, well, grab onto your seats really tight, because this is going to be crazy. I'll take a deep breath. This is going to be nuts. Frame it like this. Everything Will just told you is that the University of California is not some neutral administrator of these scientific laboratories for the federal government, but that the University of California created this mission in part. This is not what we're used to hearing. We're used to hearing that the federal government had this mission and said, you know, hey, UC, Robert Oppenheimer, Lawrence, you know, run this lab for us and build these weapons. It's a national service. This is not what happened. The University of California lobbied and created these programs to aggrandize its own power. So frame it this way. Where is policy created? Where is the power to create national policies? To a considerable extent, it's seated right here in this room, and it's on the Board of Regents in the University of California. Frame it that way. It's very important. I'm going to flood you with a bunch of information. Forgive me. I'm sorry. But I think it's kind of important. Will was talking largely about the context immediately after World War II. Through the Cold War. Of course, the Cold War was not some stable period. It was actually a hot war. There was a lot of death and destruction visited upon peoples in Vietnam and Central America. And the Cold War was anything but stable. But in terms of nuclear weapons policy, the Cold War was very stable. There was a clear, compelling mission for the scientists at the laboratories, there was an ideology which was very effective in legitimating and guiding the existence of these arsenals and these weapons. There was an evil empire, as Ronald Reagan called it. When the Soviet Union disappeared in the early 1990s, that ideology, that context all went away. And it left the nuclear weapons complex searching for a reason to exist. This is the crisis period that we're in right now, and I want to really drive this home, because those of you sitting in this room who are still here, not totally overloaded with this information, your brains aren't popping yet, really take this to heart. We're in a time of crisis for the U.S. empire and for the nuclear weapons complex, and so the actions that we take are extremely important. We have a huge ability to change things. What is this crisis exactly? It's ideological, it's infrastructural, it's fiscal, and it's managerial. I'm going to talk briefly about the ideological crisis of the nuclear weapons complex. After the fall of the Soviet Union, many believed that it would be possible to establish to bring about the spirit of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to perhaps get rid of nuclear weapons, because the standoff between the Soviet Union and the United States was through. And many thought the first step to that was the implementation of something called the Comprehensive Test Ban. Comprehensive Test Ban said that, essentially, we will stop testing nuclear weapons. All states will agree to stop testing nuclear weapons. The stakes were huge. So the social movements that promote nuclear abolition and clean social and just environments for everyone behind this, as were a lot of nation states that don't possess nuclear weapons. I'm going to read to you a quote from, this is an author named Jonathan Daly. He writes for the Congressional Research Service. That's an office of the government that writes papers for Congress that understand things better. He said, of the CTTT, many non-nuclear nations view a halt to all nuclear explosions of all types for all time as the minimum scope of the Comprehensive Test Ban. Some want to go further, restraining stewardship to cement shut the door to testing and encourage further denuclearization. For example, Indonesia would ban computer simulations of nuclear tests. Currently, the University of California builds large teraops supercomputers to simulate nuclear explosions. Most nations on Earth want to ban that practice because they recognize it as the development of nuclear weapons. Egypt, Germany, and Sweden would ban preparation for nuclear tests. Iran, Nigeria, and Pakistan would close down test sites. These were the stakes. A lot of people were pushing for this. In response to this, Clinton signed the Comprehensive Test Ban. Senate refused to ratify it, and the weapons laboratories, the UC employees who built these weapons, came up with new ideological justifications to secure their further existence, to secure multi-billion dollar budgets, and here, huge science projects in order to allow them to continue to exist along with the entire weapons complex. This was called stockpile stewardship. Stockpile stewardship is a program that's essentially an anti-disarmament program. The nuclear weapons complex is still engaged in stockpile stewardship. But this did not solve the fundamental ideological problem that's facing the complex. That is, like, there's no reason to be, there's no compelling reason for nuclear weapons to exist and the scientists to work on them. I'm going to read you a quote from C. Paul Robinson, who is a Lockheed Martin executive, and he directs the Sandia Laboratory in New Mexico. He said of this crisis, "We don't want to have people whose jobs are simply to serve as the maintenance mechanics of the doomsday machines. We really want to have people who believe that they themselves are guardians of the nation's security, whatever it takes, whatever the threats are, having people who go to bed each evening with that on their minds, waking up with ideas of what might be going on in some corner of the world and what we might do to counter it." Talks about giving rebirth to the nuclear weapons complex after that. Here's another quote. This is Edward Beckner in the NSA, National Nuclear Security Administration Deputy Director. He says, "We need to keep people thinking at the forefront, at the edge of their intellectual interests. It's important that they not be constrained to think only in terms of what's out there, what's already built." In other words, these guys who run the nuclear weapons complex are saying, look, if we don't build new weapons, and if we don't have huge budgets and compelling projects to create ever more destructive technology, then the complex itself won't be able to exist. This is the nature of the crisis. If the complex doesn't exist, we don't have nuclear weapons. If nuclear weapons don't exist, the actual existence and status of the United States as an imperial nation able to section off huge portions of the planet for its sole exploitation, for corporations to exploit these sections of the planet, is threatened. Therefore, we need programs like stockpile stewardship, but more importantly, we need a new ideology. What is the new ideology they're working on? One of the chief intellectual architects of this new ideology, his name is Stephen Younger. He was a weapons scientist at Los Alamos National Laboratory. A computational whiz kid, mathematician, computer scientist guy. Later on, he went to be a director of national security at LANL. Then he went to the Department of Defense for a while. He came back to Los Alamos as a senior fellow. And now he's actually interested in sociology, which I can tell you more about later. But he wants to apply positivist kinds of science to determine the ways that people behave so that we can better control behavior. I can tell you more about that later. This is what he says about the new nuclear weapons policies we need. He says, changes in the geopolitical environment and inexorable advance in military technology here and abroad suggest that the position of nuclear weapons and national security policy will evolve with time. He says, we may need a mixed force of weapons based on current types suitably modified to meet evolving military needs. Finally, he says, in selecting these weapons that would be maintained in a smaller force structure, consideration might be given to those that are most rugged, easiest, and cheapest to maintain, and most flexible. Highly optimized weapons may be more efficient, but efficiency can come at the cost of complexity. Basically, we need weapons that we can drop on not just states, but non-state actors. We need weapons that we can drop on terrorists. We need weapons that we can use in the war on terror. We need weapons that we can use against rogue states that may or may not have nuclear weapons. So this calls for the development of new kinds of weapons like micro-nukes and mini-nukes and the robust nuclear penetrator. And these new weapons would provide compelling, interesting ideologies and rationales for the weapons complex. And the guy who wrote his papers from the weapons complex, he's an organic intellectual coming out of it. There's an acute crisis at the laboratories, and it's basically this. You cannot manage properly a nuclear weapons laboratory. It's such a morally bankrupt thing to build weapons. I mean, the International Court of Justice has a famous ruling that says that nuclear weapons are essentially morally wrong and cannot be used in any legal way in war. This is sort of the law of the land as it's laid down, and yet these weapons exist. You can't manage these laboratories in any way that would not really result to mismanagement. So there's an acute crisis of mismanagement. There's a crisis of infrastructure. The nuclear weapons infrastructure is falling apart. There's nowhere to build plutonium bomb pits in the US anymore. There's all kinds of needs that the weapons complex has. The morale of the laboratories is at an all-time low. So how to get out of this? How to get out of this? What happened in the early 2000s is that the Department of Energy, which owns the labs, says we're going to have contract competition because we're not happy with the way the EDC is managing the labs. So here's where the new atomic trust emerges. Will was telling you about the old atomic trust. This is the new atomic trust, and in the 5 minutes remaining, I'm going to say a bunch of things about a bunch of people, which may or may not make sense. But trust me, it all fits together. So the regents, for the first time in their management of the U.S. Empire's nuclear enterprise, are threatened with a loss of these laboratories. The way they respond is thus. They significantly reorganize the entire office of the president. They create a new office within it called the Laboratory Administration Office. They hire a new UC president. And they do more. They create unprecedented for-profit business partnerships with military industrial corporations. So, who do they hire as UC president? His name is Robert Dines. And you may or may not know this about Bob Dines, but, well, he's the outgoing president now. And I can tell you stuff about the incoming president if you'd like later, but Bob Dines, the outgoing president, the guy who saved the labs for UC, he was the chancellor of UC San Diego when he was selected to be the president. Bob Dines worked at Bell Laboratories from 1969 to 1991. During most of his tenure at Bell Labs, the parent company, AT&T, managed Sandia National Laboratories in New Mexico, and Bob Dines actually worked at Sandia as a consultant, and he was a consultant at Los Alamos for nuclear weapons. So he spent most of his years in private enterprise as a nuclear weaponeer. When he came to UC San Diego, he further created linkages between the UC and the weapons laboratories. The previous chancellor of UC San Diego, Richard Atkinson, was also a Bell Labs executive when he until he became chancellor of UC San Diego, president of the UC. Bob Dines, here's a quote from Bob Dines when he was appointed president. That I kept my ties to the laboratory world since joining UCSD. I've been vice chair of the University of California President's Council on the National Laboratories, and I serve on the Council's Science and Technology Panel and National Security Panel, etc. Interesting factoids about Bob Dines. He's married to Frances Hellman, who is the daughter of the Hellman, who are the Friedman and Hellman equity investment firm of San Francisco, who are business partners with UC Regent John Moores and various high technology interests. Dines is on the board of Leap Wireless, a subsidiary of Qualcomm. Richard Atkinson is on the board of Qualcomm. So basically what I'm telling you there is that these guys are really well connected in the corporate upper echelons of the San Diego area. Dines is brought in to save the laboratories as is. Someone named Robert Foley. Robert Foley is brought in to run the laboratory management office in the UC Office of the President. It's quite likely that the person who recruits Bob Foley to come in and run this office is Richard Blum. How does Blum know Foley? Blum knows Foley because they served on the board of a company called URS for about 10 years. We already heard of URS briefly. What is URS? URS is a basically a competitor of Bechtel Corporation. So Robert Foley was on the board of this company while this company was doing business at Los Alamos, building things. Bob Foley is currently running the lab administration office. He's an ex-Navy admiral, and he sits on the board of over a dozen military industrial corporations. You can look this up on the Securities Exchange Commission. We have Peter Nanos is brought to Los Alamos to run it, Bruce Darling. I can tell you more about these people later. This is basically the new Atomic Trust, and these people are desperately searching for a way to keep the University of California firmly invested in the weapons laboratories. And it's because, it's for a lot of reasons. But again, I wanna drive this point home before ending. Policy is not, nuclear weapons policy, like a lot of policies, is not necessarily made in the Pentagon, it's not necessarily made in the White House. Policy, in effect, is largely determined by the kinds of things that are happening on the ground in various institutions. So if Los Alamos builds a plutonium bomb pit manufacturing factory in the next 5 years, which it looks like they're going to do, that could very well determine the future of nuclear weapons policy in the US. So it's not like the head of the Pentagon is going to say, we need these kinds of weapons. It's quite likely that the scientists in the weapons labs and other people with a vested interest in the weapons complex are going to advise and promote and lobby that we should have these things, and that will create the political conditions for the establishment of that. So I was going to tell you a little about some companies, but we'll skip that. The final thing I want to say, have to do this. What is this? It's not plastic. The quarantine, right? I was in the Stevens and Cafe originally, and I was eating yogurt with this. And why are these in Stevens and Cafe? Because they're compostable, right? They're sustainable, right? Ostensibly. You're skeptical. I'm skeptical too. I'm skeptical about this whole concept of sustainability. I appreciate the work of people, and I've worked on campaigns to get things like this in dining halls and facilities on campuses to make UC more sustainable. But to be quite honest, I find it kind of dubious in terms of what sustainability is. when, for instance, you're laid out with all the information that we've just tried to present you, when the core function of this institution for a long time has been the production of nuclear technology and weaponry, I'm kind of skeptical about efforts to put this in a dining hall or a cafe, and kind of like not focusing on the larger picture of what's going on. And I find contradictions in everything. For instance, one of the first companies to produce these cornstarch spoons was actually founded by a guy named Esam Khashoggi, whose brother was Adnan Khashoggi, who was the largest Saudi arms dealer in the 1980s, and he sold General Dynamics F-16s to the Saudi government, and actually part of that fortune, selling weapons to the Saudi government, led to the creation of this technology, which the Khashoggis own the patents on. Therefore, this is so sustainable, right? Well, it kind of is. But it also takes a lot of petroleum inputs to grow the GE monocrop corn that goes into these food starches that produce this, right? So what am I trying to say? I'm deeply skeptical about this concept of sustainability. I'm not sure what we're trying to sustain. And I know this is kind of a bad way for me to wrap up my rap to you in the course about sustainability. But I want to urge you to think much deeper and more systematically about what sustainability is, given that you're a part of this institution, and think about your position in perhaps changing this institution. Because again, like I said, policy isn't created from the top down. It can be also created from the bottom up, and we have a lot of power from our position here to do that. So I'll stop speaking. I will say last words.
We're already over time, so I'm going to gut everything I was going to say to wrap this up and just kind of add up a few final thoughts as parting words. And first, I want to say I agree entirely with the core of what Darwin's saying. I would say it a little bit differently. I would say it's not sustainability that I disagree with, but it's the form concept of sustainability that institutions like the UC and like British Petroleum, which is now Beyond Petroleum, right, subscribe to. Los Alamos National Laboratory awarded something called the Ernest O. Lando Lawrence Award. You know, this is an award that they created to commemorate the best scientists of Los Alamos for something called green explosives. Okay, these are explosives that reduce the amount of environmental toxins, which is great, but the doomsday machine rolls on, right? If you have nuclear weapons running on geothermal energy, there's still nuclear weapons, and I think we gotta get beyond the types of sustainability that we get confined into thinking about by the interests of people and institutions like British Petroleum. And we gotta look at holistically how is the institution like the UC that we're participating in actually interacting, and what is its actual relationship with the natural environment. It's been the main nuclear weapons research contract for the US government, discovered plutonium, it's conducted nuclear weapons tests. There's all kinds of other things the UC is involved with that are not sustainable, but you've got to look at how the power structure of this university operates in order to look at those things. And I really want to give a shout out and thank the people within administrative positions in the UC who allow things like ESLP to happen, who sanction things like ESLP, because the UC is not one thing. And I was going to give this wrap about a people's history of the UC, because just as much as the UC throughout its history has been used by people who are part of the ruling elite to do things that are not in the interests of life on this planet, like create a massive stockpile of nuclear weapons, it's just as often been used by people like us in positions of students, faculty, and staff to organize, to create new ideas that actually serve the interests of life on the planet. There's a concept. And to organize social movements. The UC has been a base for so many social movements over the years that have done good things. Obviously, it hasn't been enough. There's a lot going on right now. And I want to close out by saying that there is nothing about this world that we live in that is inevitable. It was not inevitable that the University of California was going to hire Ernest Lawrence and that he was going to help create nuclear weapons. The nuclear weapons were going to proliferate all over the world. There were conscious decisions by people in positions of power that led to that happening. And if you're someone who's a ruling elite, right, in the world, you can justify anything you want. George Berkeley helped justify genocide. You can justify genocide if that's what you think is in your interest and people have. You can justify creating enough nuclear weapons to destroy life on the planet multiple times over. People have done that who are part of this institution. People can justify anything. And what we have to do in order to evaluate what they're trying to justify is actually look at the values that we hold dear, what's really important, what it means to be human, okay? Clean air, clean water, clean soil, clean earth, okay? We've got to look at things like real functioning human community. That's something that's foreign to most of us because of the type of society we've grown up in. Something we can manifest at a place like the UC. There's something about the UC that serves the interests of social movements well if it's taken advantage of, and that's that there's something that I refer to as social capital here. There's a lot of people at UC campuses that are critically examining the role that their university is playing in society. They're examining the society in general. They're examining these deeper questions. We can organize among people who are our peers to look at these things, and our responsibility is to look as deeply as we can, because we live at a time when the future of our planet is at stake, and it's at stake because of things like this. It's at stake because of things that people who are in charge of this university have done. It's at stake because people who are students, faculty, and staff of this university have done, and it's up to the people who are here to look at those things and turn the tide towards something that serves those types of interests that I just referred to, okay, in a better way. And there's things like LRDP resistance that you can join up with. There's things like UCD Mill. You're already here at ESLP. You're doing a lot of great things. I don't know most of you on an individual level, but it looks to me like you're doing great things because you're still here. You've got an interest in what the hell I'm talking about, so obviously you're pretty cool. So take advantage of the position you're in, because if you were an Iraqi, if you're a Navajo uranium miner, if you're someone who's lived downwind of nuclear weapons tests in the Marshall Islands, what would you demand of someone who's a student at the University of California to do? You would demand that you do everything in your power, okay, to commit yourself to actually turning the course of this university system, which is so powerful in the world, toward an actual form of sustainability that's acceptable to life on this planet. I want to leave it there. Thank you very much for listening.